Devices Radio Network.
Drugs and Stuff is for informational, educational purposes only. And this program is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code ADVICES at checkout. Welcome back to Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland. I'm Scott McNally. This program is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the show and to get some additional savings. Dave Crossland, what's up, man? How you been?
Shit.
Oh. That's very blunt. That's not very British and polite of you.
No, I apologize. I had a somewhat trying and emotional week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Would you care to share?
You will notice that there is a lot less snoring in the background today.
Okay, yes. Now, I didn't know if you were going to want to talk about that on the air, so I didn't even plan on asking, but we're going to go there. Yeah, so I saw a post by, well, actually, I made a post, and your wife commented on it, and I got the gist of what was happening. We talked a little bit, but why don't you tell everybody at home?
Unfortunately, one of my bulldogs, Buster, had to be put down this last week, so the atmosphere in the house is a bit miserable, to say the least.
I'm sorry, man. I really am.
Well, his behavior deteriorated quite strongly. He was a rescue dog anyway. He had a history of bad behavior before coming to us. And we were heavily tied with the Rescue Association with looking after him. And we had a couple of incidents, and they were getting worse, and he was getting more aggressive and more unpredictable. And the decision was made after another incident that enough was enough. And it's not uncommon for bulldogs to have neurological problems, which cause aggressive deterioration in the behavior. And the decision was made that the fair thing was to put him to sleep, rather than risk someone getting seriously hurt, because the last incident was a little bit close, shall we say.
I understand. Yeah, from what you had explained to me, man, I hate to see it happen, but I totally understand it. And you know what else I'll tell you too? It was kind of, I don't know if ironic's the right word, but I had found an article last week, and it was from Vice, and it talked about that how losing a pet is just as traumatic, if not more in some cases, than it's just as traumatic as losing a person in your life. And I shared that because it was something I really agreed with. And your wife had came on and she said, we lost our dog this week. And I was in shock because I just spoke to you just a couple days before, and your dogs were both snorting and having a good old time in the recording room there. And I know how much your pets mean to you. You're a person who loves animals. So I'm sorry.
Oh, it's no one's fault. You just feel like because he was a rescue and because we were supposed to be his sanctuary, he'd been ill-treated as a pup. That was some of the driving factor behind some of his behavior problems. But, we've had him 3 years. You feel like you failed him. You feel like you've let down, because you were supposed to be something. You were supposed to be the safety net where he was going to get old and fat and fluffy and farty and everything else. And unfortunately, it hasn't been that. So, yeah, you do feel very much like you've let your animal down and you failed to a large extent. But, at the same time, I was brought up on farms. I'm a realist and I accept that sometimes these things have to be done. Hey ho. Anyway, let's not labor the fact. We don't want to put everybody on a downer.
right. No, but there was some other stuff we had to talk about. Now we'll get to this in a few minutes. You have some information. One of the questions we had last week was about eyesight and CIRMs. So we'll get to that. But before that, I wanted to ask you. You were talking a little bit about this new research project that you're somewhat involved with. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I don't qualify actually because I'm too old.
Okay.
But basically, there's a project going on at the moment, and it has to be someone who's living in England or Scotland or Wales, sort of thing. And they're looking for users aged between 20 and 35, either that have just finished a cycle and have used steroids for a minimum of 20 weeks or have previously used for a period of time and have been off 2 to 4 years.
Okay.
Now, some will know this, some won't, but one of the ways steroids work within the muscle is they activate satellite cells that are donated into muscle fiber. Now, these myonuclei are then used to increase rates of protein synthesis and subsequently hypertrophy. Obviously, that has to come from a signal to grow from stimulation from training.
Yeah.
Now, one of the theories is, and one of the explaining factors behind muscle memory is that when we stop using, these nuclei remain in the muscle fiber.
Okay.
So you still have that baseline signaling for an increased ability to grow muscle fiber post a steroid cycle than you would your natural version prior to that. So this research is actually funded by WADA, and I think effectively what they're looking at is do competition cheats have a sustained advantage over their counterparts that have never used. So therefore they'd have to look at reviewing current ban lengths for people that are tested positive for steroid use.
Okay.
And potentially, I suppose, though it would be a very convoluted way, they could look at muscle fiber nuclei as a way of testing for previous steroid use, even if it was 2, 3, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But it would appear that there is a definitely a long-term advantage to having used steroids at one point or another.
Huh.
So that's basically the study that they're looking at. But one thing that came off this, which I found quite interesting, we got talking when I was speaking to the guy that's doing the research. We also got talking about the whole transgender issue.
Okay.
And that was really interesting because though it's not exogenous anabolic steroid use, we are still looking at an individual that had an exposure to a much higher level of testosterone than their opposite sex counterpart has. So basically a male wanting to be a female, because there aren't many transgender sports athletes going the opposite way.
Right.
What he was saying was, yeah, at the moment, a transgender male converting to female has to undergo 3 years treatment before they're eligible to compete as a female.
Really?
Yeah. Now, if this research shows what they think, that there is a permanent change in satellite cell structure within the muscle fiber, and therefore a permanent advantage installed in that individual, then this would potentially look at changing that situation so that transgenders would be banned.
Okay.
Or it may put an extended time scale on that. But effectively, we were discussing the environment of development in a testosterone environment, then subsequent estrogen supplementation in order to become female. And the general consensus is that there would still be a physical structural advantage, muscularly. I mean, obviously, there's skeletal advantages anyway, and skeletal structure in a male is different to a female, but they are very much of the opinion that there would be potentially a permanent muscular structural advantage
Sure.
over their natural born female competitors, and therefore they wouldn't be eligible to compete.
Yeah, I mean I guess I get it. I don't know. I mean, I saw, I saw a transgender person that competed in, I think, and it was in women's physique. So it was somebody who was a male who became a female and then competed in women's physique. And I mean, basically, this person, I mean, there's some girls out there that have a lot of muscle, but this was like legitimately like a very jacked guy,
Yeah.
and I don't know. I don't know how I feel. Is that fair to the other women? I don't know. But it is definitely raising a lot of questions now, now that all these things are kind of like becoming more mainstream,
Well, we got onto a lot of other stuff as usual with these sort of conversation, one thing leads to another. So we started looking at embryonic development, well, discussing embryonic development in an estrogen environment as opposed to a testosterone environment. And it's proven, it's not something up for debate, that embryonic development in a testosterone environment changes the brain structure in certain ways that leads male to be more apt at spatial awareness and hand-eye coordination type stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So males are genetically pre-positioned to be better at hands-on things, where females are genetically more prone to be better at languages and intellect-based things.
Yeah.
And so we started then to discuss that, what about that level of pre-programming in natural genetic aptitude towards certain things over, you know, a child that's been developed in an Eastern environment would have a natural aptitude towards different things. So there's a preset genetic advantage there towards certain things.
That makes sense. Sure.
And then off that, now I've touched on this a couple of times over the last few years, and quite often, well, quite honestly, I've just been laughed at for suggesting it. I am convinced that paternal use, so use by the father, affects DNA and RNA expression in the sperm donation to the offspring.
The so use of like testosterone? Also,
if daddy uses, he affects the genetic blueprint of their offspring. Now, you don't change DNA, but DNA has an expression that can vary. So you can strengthen that signal or you can reduce that signal depending on certain environmental factors inputted upon the parents.
Sure.
So if somebody has a genetic predisposition to be lean, depending on the environment in which the parent is brought up, that signal strength can be increased or decreased to some degree. Meaning that then the offspring may have a predisposition to be even leaner, or it may be toned down to some degree. And we saw in the Dutch famines that starving parents, particularly males, altered the metabolic rate of their offspring, causing them to be predisposed to be obese. Because the signaling from the sperm, the RNA signaling, it's basically said in very layman simplified terms, you need to have a slow metabolic rate because there's no fucking food. Obviously, the offspring weren't born into the starvation that the parents were experiencing when they were conceived. And so food was at an increased level, but their bodies were pre-programmed to be very conservative with calorie expenditure. And as a result, a large portion of the children born of starving parents suffer obesity.
That makes sense to me, sure.
So I've always believed that paternal use can have an impact on the offspring of users.
I was going to say, I've talked to a lot of people who say that, like, that this has been a couple people have said it to me, actually, that they think that, like, people on gear, guys on gear, always produce females. They always produce girl babies.
Now, that was based on a naval study that was somewhat weak in its controls.
Okay.
There was a study supported that, but I believe it was done on Navy personnel. And to be fair, there's a lot of holes in it. But anecdotally, I've spoke to a lot of people who have had offspring, and they pretty much all report that their children are above average intelligence and develop very, very quickly when it comes to intellect. However, on the flip side of that, that their children are easily bored, require a high level of stimulus, and that can soon manifest as behavioral problems if they're not continually stimulated in a positive way. So we were discussing the possibilities of researching into this and how to do it and everything else, which apparently wouldn't be overly complex to put a research project together to do it.
Yeah.
And so I've told him once he gets this one out of the way, if he's seriously interested, we'll sit down and discuss a potential look at paternal use in offspring. I mean, user numbers now, just in the UK alone, are probably touching well in excess of 1 million. I personally feel they're nearer the 2 million mark.
Wow.
So there is the potential of a big impact. And it's not that he's necessarily going to be a negative thing. I mean, there are some positive elements to this influence as well. And like a lot of things, it's what you do with that base change.
Yeah.
But you know, with the what we're seeing more and more about mental health within users and those sort of things, I do think it's something that may warrant an actual serious look at. Anyway,
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting,
so
man.
that was pretty much my week.
Sounds like some heavy stuff. Hey, so your last episode we had gotten a question about a guy who's dealing with eyesight issues. I believe he said he has cataracts, and he said he believed that it was from the use of estrogen blockers. His question was, is there anything that we could suggest to him that would not have an impact on his eyes?
Surprised actually that when I started looking at this and how obvious and readily available information was on it, that I'd never actually come across it before. With regards Novadex, that a lot of the research comes from cancer treatments when Novadex was dosed at 100 to 150 milligrams per day. And basically, the problems within eyesight were caused because Novadex blocks the estrogen receptors within the eyes. And that was where apparently estrogen has a very positive effect in the eye, both in maintaining and managing regular vision, and also fluid levels within the eye. So the most common side effect is dry eyes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And this is due to Novadex blocking the estrogen receptor. Now, Adex and Letrol obviously can have a very similar effect, but the mechanism is slightly different. So, whereas Novadex will block the actual receptors within the eye, so low estrogen only occurs within the eye, whether and has no impact on the actual estrogen levels within the body, Adex and Letrol obviously force estrogen levels to be lower. So in their situation, it's an actual overall low level of estrogen which can cause issues. But I would suspect that in order for estrogen levels to get to that level in the whole body, you would also be experiencing side effects in the way of libido issues and low estrogen-related sides in other parts of the body, not just your eyesight.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'd think that by then you would probably experience it. Well, and I guess that's something to look out for too, because I know that we have a lot of guys that will tank their estrogen. And what are the side effects they're looking for? A lot of times they're looking for libido, joint issues. Now we can add to that list any type of eyesight issues that could potentially happen. Which doesn't sound good, man. I mean, you can always fix a crashed libido. You can always, work around joint issues, but eyesight, man, I don't want to mess with that.
And at the moment, I've not really found much about how long lasting these effects are, and much on recovery if you get your estrogen levels back up, having had problems with vision due to low estrogen. So yeah, definitely. More common than I realized, a lot of evidence on it within cancer patients. And it is literally that estrogen has a very important role to play in eyesight.
That's interesting, man. Well, something that I think we should all pay attention to. Hey, you've got a bunch of questions. I think I'm looking at your Facebook right now. You grabbed a bunch of questions. We got a like a whole show's worth of material here, Dave, in like a
No,
matter of 30 minutes.
let's have a look.
You
I
kind of.
know, sometimes you just land lucky. Yeah, I've got a book.
You
So there's a few of my good ones.
you're pretty popular. That's what I have to say.
No.
I'm gonna like your post right now. What do you say What do you say we go to a quick break and come back and tackle some of this stuff?
Yep, no problem.
All right, guys, we will be back in just a minute. Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows. Hey guys, I wanted to take this break to say thanks to Dave for everything he's doing here at ADVICES Radio, and thanks to Dave for everything he's doing for bodybuilding as a whole. You guys can check out more of his stuff. Go visit his website. It's crosslands.org.uk. That's crosslands.org.uk. Crosslands Harm Reduction Service specializes in providing concise, informative, and effective drug training to a wide range of professions, as well as advice to individual users. You guys can also check Dave out on his YouTube page, which is in the show notes. And also go to underconstructionthefilm.com to purchase the films today. Use the code ADVICES25 for a discount. All right, guys, and we are back. Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland. I'm Scott McNally, and we are over on Dave's Facebook page. He made this thread looking for questions for the show. So thank you, guys, everybody who has participated. And listen, we need questions for the next episode. So what I am going to ask you to do is go over to the forum, go to forum.advicesradio.com. You'll see the various sections there. Go into the bodybuilding section, which is very close to the top, and there are threads stickied for all the shows, including this one, Drugs and Stuff. So go over to the, you can either get there that way, or if you just go to advicesradio.com, you can just click on the forum button and you'll get in there that way. But please, yeah, let's get some good questions for Dave for the next episode. And for now, we are going to start here at Facebook. Dave, based on what you know now, what would you have done differently regarding your drug use over the years? I bet you I can guess a couple things.
Go on, man.
Okay, you probably would not have dosed growth hormone as high as you did.
Yes. Well...
Now
we've got there's two sides to this question, you see, so it depends how you want to look at this.
Okay.
If we're talking about why I would change my cycles for more effective results.
Ah, okay.
Yes. If you're talking, do I regret doing what I did? No, because that's what helped me get to where I am now knowledge-wise.
True. You may not have felt that way about growth hormone had you not known, but I just know that you've said, you know, your main thought is growth is not going to trigger, you know, quote unquote, muscle growth, big muscle growth. You're not going to get huge from growth. So, you know, I've heard enough of your advice to know that you suggest keeping it more moderate. Use it for the fat loss, you know, use it to stay lean while you're growing, but don't expect to get huge and don't take like 30 units of human grade growth.
Yeah. Or you know, obviously increase your recovery. But if you're going to increase your recovery, increase your training frequency to take advantage of that increase.
Yeah.
But no, and I mean, there's still a lot of people out there that hammer home growth for muscle mass, growth for muscle mass, growth for muscle mass. There seems to be more and more people starting to think a little bit the way I do. but there is still and some very popular and some very knowledgeable people still support high dose growth as an effective compound for growing muscle mass. So yeah, I mean, if you're looking at it from a point of view of what would I change in regards to the drugs I use from a point of view of sustaining mass, I wouldn't have run the high dose growth. I wouldn't have run the high dose insulin. Those two would have gone straight away. I may have used the insulin in another manner, and I think I'd have probably looked at using low dose with meals just to help my own natural system push that food through. Regards the other drugs, I don't think I'd have gone down the line of Tren. And I literally, like a lot of people, when I went to use Tren, it was just a case of, you know what? Everyone says this stuff is rocket fuel. Let's see what it can do. Retrospectively, I don't think the sides or the potential sides are worth the impact that it had. I didn't really see any better growth. In fact, I saw more problems and more restrictions in growth from using Tren than I did from using high dose Deca, and I think that was very much to do with the levels of toxicity. So I think because Tren is more powerful, obviously I should have probably run it at a lot lower dose than I did, but I didn't. And I think that it was, I basically made myself overly toxic, which actually restricted growth more than the trend was giving me an advantage at growing. Whereas the deca is a lot milder in that department, also an anti-inflammatory. So it would have helped more if I'd stuck to my tried and tested testing deca for mass building, which I've always found to be basically as good as anything.
Yeah, that's fair enough, man. I don't know if I would have done too much. You know what? I probably wouldn't have used as quite as much as I did now, looking back, just because I feel like you felt with the growth hormone. For me, I think that I got more wrapped. You know what I would do, Dave? I got wrapped up in thinking about all, like trying to make it real scientific and thinking like, well, if this ester, peaks at this time, then I need to use these fast acting compounds here and this compound. I wasted so much time. I wish I would have just spent that time focusing on something more important, like learning more about my nutrition or training. Just kept it simple with the gear and just pushed forward,
I mean, I think retrospectively, from a point of view of the effect on my physique, I should never have gone on to that cycle for UC2. Retrospectively, for my learning and life experience, I don't regret it in that sense at all, because it was very productive in a lot of other ways. But from a physique strength development side, it was completely a waste of time. And I functioned better hanging around 350 to 360 in half decent condition for the weight, with a good power, a good mobility. And I would have been better staying around that weight and just, refining at that point.
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely. All right, I'm going to move on to the next one here. This is an interesting question. Now, we talk about low dose gear. A lot of it is what we've suggested now. Realistic expectations of low dosages, like 250 to 300 milligrams a test a week for someone that is new to usage.
I think you're gonna get a reasonable response. I mean, let's assume that what you're getting is what you're trying to get, and you are. We're not taking into account possibilities of underdosing and all that crap. The biggest impact here is going to be on how well organized you are when it comes to your food and your training. If your training and food is where it needs to be, and you really are pushing hard, then you can see some quite dramatic results of some relatively nominal doses. And I've seen people put good solid strength and size on doses of 200, 250, 300 mg a week, on doses of 40 mg a D-ball a day on its own. I mean, when you look back at the Russian studies on Tura-bolin, and when we touched on this previously, there were people putting very impressive performance increases of 10, 12, 15%. And when people are at the top of the game and they're dosing 20, 30 milligram of T-ball a day and they're getting that sort of result, but that's because as a trained individual, they were very efficient in their training and what they did. So the better your ability to train, the more efficient your ability at training, and the harder you train, and the same with your nutrition, the less drugs you will require to get a noticeable response. The problem is that when most people start their first cycles, they may only be, well, these days, they may only be 2 weeks into their training, but traditionally, you're 3, 4, 5 years into your training, and though you may have a decent base, you're nowhere near as advanced as you're going to be at 10 years. And I think that's one of the biggest deciding factors is the more on point you are with your training and diet, the better response you'll get at much lower doses. And I've seen some, I finished with a client this week actually because he's going to compete now, so I don't do comp prep and all that bollocks. And I think he was 51, and he was on a combined dose of about 900 mg a week. And in 8 weeks, he landed a solid 11 kilo and was 1% leaner in body fat. And if you say that to people, like, bullshit, that doesn't happen. You can't put that much on. Numbers are there. And his stats were recorded independently by an outside company. And it's just, if you're on point with training, you don't need a huge amount of anabolics to kick you over the edge and really start you growing.
I've got a couple of thoughts here, Dave. Let's also speculate, where was his natural test levels to begin with? If we have a guy who already had like very high natural test levels, maybe and maybe and let's also look at someone's response to injecting test. We know that not everybody is going to get the exact same results from taking, but the exact same blood levels from, say, taking 250 milligrams of test. For one guy, he might get levels that are through the roof. For another guy, it may be more moderate. I've seen people that need that, they're on HRT and they keep testing back at a lower end, and the doctor has to push the dose up because they just aren't getting their numbers up high enough with what might have helped somebody else a lot. So there's that. And then, like I mentioned too, if the guy already had naturally really high test levels, for all we know, 250 might just replace that.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, I have seen natural levels that exceed range.
Okay, man. How did that person's physique look in comparison?
Unfortunately, I only saw the blood work side of things. But I think they were something at 43 and more.
Oh, geez. So what compare that to what's like an average?
22.
So we're talking like basically twice as much natural
Yeah, I
test.
mean, this is definitely somebody that would need would probably actually need to have scans to see if there's some issue with the pituitary that's causing this extra hormone production. But, I've seen people running 200 mega tests a week that are only getting test levels in that range. So if someone's naturally on the very high end of natural production, then a starter cycle of 200, 250 mg a week is probably going to have very little impact. But if somebody's on the natural end, mid to low end test production, then obviously a low dose cycle is going to have a much greater impact in how they respond to that. So it's a very valid point as to the relationship between test levels on a low dose and your natural test levels. The greater that divide, the greater that difference, the bigger effect it's going to appear to have on you.
So that makes sense. So I guess going into it, This is a question from a guy named Alan. Going into it, Alan, I'd want to know where your natural levels were to begin with, just so you, because I've seen guys who they don't understand. I mean, at the same time, Dave, there's going to be like a minimal effective dose, right?
Yes.
Like you can't be like, oh, I'm going to take 50 milligrams of test just for a little bump. At that point, you're probably going to be counterproductive, shutting
Well,
down
you've
your
got to
own.
remember that when you take tests, your natural levels will suppress. So if you take tests that only replaces your natural production, then you're going to see no real benefit. You'll see a very slight increase because you're stabilizing or plateauing your levels at a much higher level than you would naturally, because naturally they're going to ebb and flow to a large degree. Beyond that, you're not going to see a great deal of change. So, the change has to be in the circulating blood plasma levels. If that's a great enough increase in that level, then you will see improvements.
And if you were, I think you make a good point too, that you're going to have these stable levels. One place it might be beneficial is, let's say somebody was dieting down, and if you diet down naturally, your test often would drop as you get leaner and leaner and push harder and harder. Like if you're getting to contest shape, if you were on, just a replacement dose of test at that point, you might get more benefit out of it then. To be able to help maintain higher levels, or higher average levels versus being natural. So in that respect, dieting down, you could get something out of it. But realistically, man, if my thought is, if I'm going to take something, I want to at least make it worthwhile. Do you think, let me ask you this, Dave, do you think that the, what's the harm, or what's the risk to benefit ratio of 250 versus 500 test. You know what I'm saying? Where would you put that?
Generally, I would say probably not much of a greater increase in risk. Definitely not in the short term, anyway. Definitely not when you're talking sort of 8, 12 week cycle type timing. Benefit wise, yes, you're going to see a much greater benefit from the 500. Most people don't, because there's lacking in their training or their diet, and generally they're using the drugs to compensate for that. So a lot you get as much out as they can out of cycles. But yeah, definitely.
It's like, with at least with testosterone, our goal is to, if we're trying to use this for performance or image enhancement, we're looking to get like a supra physiological dose or level in our blood. If you use it just to get a natural level, then you're just going to have it, then it works like a natural hormone in your body. If you double it, then it becomes a drug and drug-like.
Yeah, I mean, academia argued for a very, very long time about the fact that if you increase the dose, you'd increase the effects. In fact, for a very long time, for nigh on 50 years, they said that wouldn't happen. Something that we all knew as users did. There was only one ever study, I believe, done, which was dosed at 200, 400, and 600 milligrams in humans, and they did show a bigger dose, a bigger impact.
No kidding.
The only thing was they were non-trained individuals, so they weren't training. And obviously those results are not sustained. But yeah, all things being equal, to a certain point, the more you take, the better response you're going to get. But there are points when that becomes a negative because of toxicity and side effects and other things that then start creating a negative environment for growth.
Like something like, B12. I've heard of people that want to start megadosing B12, but then my understanding is that, you're only going to use what your body is going to use, and then you're going to pee the rest out, but with something like a steroid, this is only going to continue to build up and it will become drug-like. So my thought is, man, use that, at least that, like that minimal effective dose, you know, to at least get the most you can before it starts, you know, going the other direction and that side effects become more of an issue.
Yeah, no, I agree. Which is why generally we say starter cycles are 400 to 500 milligram.
There you go. Yeah.
Because anecdotally, that seems to have been a dosing that gives you the best trade-off between dealing with side effects and physical response.
I never asked you, what do you think about kick-starting a cycle? Like, you know, say using D-ball for the first 4 weeks while you wait for that test to build up.
The thing is, test blood plasma levels spike on every ester within somewhere between 12 and 36 hours.
Okay.
So it doesn't build up in the way people think. However, your body's response to the drug text happening. You will feel it quicker with a fast-acting ester because the actual concentration of hormone per milliliter fluid you're getting, per milligram you're getting, because you've got less of a ester weight in there. So I can never remember the exact numbers, but I think a test end for 100 milligrams actually only contains 70 milligrams of hormone, where 100 milligrams of test pops is about 82 milligrams of hormone.
Okay.
But plasma levels peak very, very quickly. So I've never really bought into the front load sort of idea. The other thing with front loading is you're pushing it in the sense that you're more likely to get an immune response. Your body's never been good at responding to sudden change.
Hmm.
It responds a lot better to gradual change. It will always adversely react or fight back if you try and do things quickly. Where if you're more gradual, it will accept that. And test flu is a big problem for a lot of people, or generally feeling unwell in the beginning of a cycle is a big problem for a lot of people. And that is exacerbated if you front load, because you've got this sudden rush of hormone coming into your body and your body's like, oh, fuck, what's this? I'm going to try and fight against it. And it creates an immune response.
Yeah.
The other thing is, at the end of the day, people say, oh, well, it gets in your system faster, so I'm growing quicker. Well, no, not really. All you're doing is creating a bigger dose at the beginning than you would be for the rest of the cycle. Now, if anything, I'd be looking at increasing my dose towards the back end of my cycle.
Why is that?
To continue stimulating a forward movement of growth.
Mm.
Same with my food.
Yeah.
So I would track the cycle and the food so they continually move up slightly throughout the cycle.
I like that. I like that a lot, actually.
And though we don't get a desensitization in androgen receptors and we don't get other things, we do get an increase in other aspects of toxicity and RBC levels. So as you go through your cycle, it becomes harder and harder for your body to respond.
Yeah.
Not because it's not responding to the androgens at the receptor or anything else, but generally because everything else is starting to get hard work. So it's having to fight more. You're carrying more weight. That's more draining. That takes an impact on your recovery time.
Yeah.
Your blood pressure's increased. That has an impact on your recovery time. So you get more tired. Your quality of sleep starts to deteriorate because you're heavier. It may even be that your breathing is affected, compromised, because you're heavier, and you may start to suffer sleep apnea towards the back end of the cycle. So that steady increase of dose, or that periodic upping of the dose slightly, is going to allow an element of drug overcompensation for these problems that start. I mean, obviously, there's a point where you've got to say, no, I need to come off. It's got to such a level it's becoming negative now, I need to come off.
Yeah.
But I do feel that a carefully managed cycle with increases at the right points, particularly off season, will sustain go for a much longer period of time.
Hmm.
Strangely enough, the reverse when you're dieting for a comp.
Okay.
in my opinion, because you want less toxicity gain as you get close to the comp because your body is more and more fragile. Because body fat levels are lower, stress levels are higher, and you're not going to grow, so why would you add extra drugs in 2 weeks out?
Well, I think what's the normal logic here, Dave? People, well, first, I mean, you want hardeners in. So a lot of times, like if I were gonna do a prep near the end, I would add in, whatever, Winstrol, Halo, Masteron, whatever, to get that finished appearance. But
Yeah, then you remove something else. Don't increase your total drug toxicity.
I might. Or I might not. I might just increase
Most
it.
people do, but one thing you've got to look at when you look at drugs and you look at cycles
Yeah.
is to look at the overall toxicity of those drugs.
think, yeah, that's a good point.
So you look at the overall stress. So you can't, it's like, you see with a lot of powerlifters, they go on trend very early on.
Yeah.
Powerful drug, but also quite toxic. And then as they're getting close to the comp, they're adding in check drops, they're adding in test base, they're adding in Halo. All these drugs that are proven performance enhancers when it comes to strength. But they get to the show and they're so fucked that their lifts start to go back down.
Yeah.
So you've got to look at managing toxicity levels moving into an event, particularly with powerlifting and strongman.
Okay.
So that you don't bring your high androgens in too early and then lose the benefit of them because you've been on them too long and you've turned toxic. Off season, see, I tend to stay away from high androgens
Okay.
and stick to more milder drugs, which allow me to increase the dose going towards the end of the cycle because I'm not turning toxic because I've not run heavy compounds.
Yeah.
So I'll use like Deca, because it is such a low androgen profile and a high anabolic, it's far less stressful on the body. And I've said many times, it's an anti-inflammatory as well. So it keeps overall inflammation down, which aids recovery.
Yeah. You had gotten me into the Deca idea. I had not used it in years. I've been on 300 now for maybe a couple of eight weeks, maybe something like that. I can tell the difference. In the past, man, I would have thought like, well, if I'm going to do this, I need to take, 700 milligrams. But 300 milligrams, I can tell the difference. I feel like everything feels better. Joints, inflammation. It's been a decent compound for me just at that dose.
Good.
I like it. All right, I'll move on to the next one here.
So we went off a bit off topic there,
It was good. It was good. We started getting some deeper information out of it. I like that. Let's see here. This is you know what? I'm gonna skip down to the last question. We can come back to that one. The effects of trenbolone on stamina. That's a good one. I think a lot of people don't really notice this unless they're like a competitor in a stamina type sport like MMA. I know that those guys have talked about noticing that their stamina goes down on tren. In general, though, I think like your average bodybuilder, we aren't doing enough stuff to really feel a huge hit. Do you talk to guys that experience stamina issues while on tren?
Yeah, I've got a few guys, and I think it's down to a lot of how these guys choose to train as to how much they notice the differences or not.
Yeah.
Most will say it's rather than stamina, it's a cardiovascular ability more in line with their ability to breathe.
Yeah, okay.
Rather than they lose the ability to perform in a stamina role from a muscularity point of view. So most people that I've ever spoken to have said, well, my CV's wrecked. And it's the breathing. That's where how it's affected their stamina. What it hasn't done is affected the endurance ability of the muscle.
Okay.
I don't think anyone is truly 100% sure on what trend does.
Yeah.
And why it affects our ability to breathe. I believe it's something to do with a blood cell contraction within the lungs, a restriction, a constriction, should I say, within blood flow within the lungs,
Okay.
which then causes our ability to absorb and utilize oxygen to be impaired. But I can't really tell you more than that as to what is the mechanism that causes that. I don't know. And I've not found anything that says otherwise or gives me any more in any direction on why Tren is so impacting on the cardiovascular ability of certain people. I mean, a lot of people report Tren cough. Now, a lot get that confused as well with the aspiration of benzyl alcohol through the lungs because they've got the gear into a blood vein when they've injected. A coughing fit post-injection isn't Tren cough. A coughing fit post-injection is because you've somehow got that into your bloodstream very, very quickly. And that has the benzyl alcohol has then come out through the lungs and caused a restriction effect within the lungs. Tren cough is a sustained cough, like a dry throat, tickly cough that is ongoing, or a lung cough that is ongoing continuously. That's Tren cough. And it just seems to have this effect on the constriction in within the lungs, the blood vessels within the lungs. But the mechanism of what is play that is at play at that, I don't know. I mean, regards generally for, I mean, all steroids increase red blood cell count. Obviously, we know stuff like equipoise and oxandrolone do it to a greater impact than other drugs do, which is why they're used in treatments of anemias. But then most, you know, a lot of high-end endurance athletes' drugs for choice is EPO because it increases red blood cell count and therefore increases the oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood. So if anything, steroids should, to some degree, improve our endurance because they increase our red blood cell.
That's up until the point where what your blood gets too thick and then it starts slowing it back down, right?
Well, yeah, but then when you look at top pro athletes, and I believe, I don't know if it's still the case, that the record for the lowest heart rate beat, resting heart rate beat, was actually held by a professional cyclist.
Okay.
And there's been stories of cyclists on EPO that have to get up in a night and cycle to get their blood rates up because it moves so slow because the blood is so thick.
Yeah, yeah.
So it seems to interact with people in different ways depending on their level of fitness, and particularly on the level of cardiac fitness, as in how strong their hearts are. But one of the, because obviously one of the impacts from steroid use on the heart is an increase in heart wall thickness.
Yeah.
And that is partly because the heart is a muscle and it has to beat harder in order to push the thicker blood round.
Yeah.
And that causes the heart wall to thicken as it works harder to do that. But at the same time, you've got endurance athletes getting their RBCs as high as they possibly can to increase their oxygenated red blood so they get more oxygen to their muscles for their aerobic exercise.
Yeah.
Go on.
I was going to ask you, have you ever used EPO?
No, never.
Or have you talked to clients, people that you know, and maybe not even clients, but people you've advised that had been using it? Because I'll tell you what, man, that stuff scares the hell out of me.
It's a drug I have had very little involvement with.
Okay.
And I have possibly maybe only one or two clients I've ever come across that were involved with EPO.
Okay.
And they were running blood values that would have been what I would have suggested were problematic for a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
With no real issues, and it's the only thing I can bring it down to is their heart conditioning was so much greater because of what they did. And these were guys that were cycling hundreds of miles a week.
Oh, wow.
So their heart conditioning was so much further on than your typical bodybuilders.
Can you explain, you know, what the risk is here of getting your blood too thick? whether it be through EPO or, Anadrol or EQ, just for anybody who doesn't understand this. Because, I think we're all aware of liver issues with taking orals, but beyond that, people, they don't really, I think, get what could happen.
Well, obviously, your blood floats around your body. It's a viscous fluid, so it's water-based. And when you take drugs of that nature, they increase the number of red blood cells in the blood and the size of the red blood cells in the blood. And as a result, the blood gets thicker. So it's still water-based, but it's carrying more gloop about, for want of a better term.
Yeah.
This initially will cause the heart to have to work harder because it's now pumping thicker fluid about. This in turn will cause the heart wall to start to thicken. It will also increase blood pressure. And that's just simple physics. You know, if you've got a light fluid going through a tube, it will require less pressure at the back of it to move it than if you had a thick fluid going through a tube.
Yeah.
Sludge is harder to move than water.
And that's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah. So your heart's working harder. Now, where I think bodybuilders fall foul over endurance athletes on high red blood cell count is we just don't have that level of cardiac fitness.
Yeah.
And we have a much larger body mass. So we're not only dealing with thick red blood cells, we're also dealing with a big, vast body that we're trying to pump this blood around.
Yeah.
The second issue is that obviously steroids alter your cholesterol profiles. They lower HDL, they increase LDL. This in turn creates us in a situation where we're more likely to have arterial wall plaque build up. So now what we've got is we've got a narrowing of the tubes that which our blood travels down, and the blood's got thicker. Two things can potentially happen here. The first thing is that the plaque can break off and then cause a blockage. And the second thing is that the thick blood in its own right causes a blockage.
Yeah. And what is that, what does that mean, cause a blockage? What does that mean in the, like, what will happen to you?
Well, physically, you end up with a heart attack.
Okay.
And damage is done to your cardiovascular system. And what usually will happen at this point is you will require a stent, which is a tube that's fitted inside your artery to enlarge it and support the arterial wall.
Okay.
And then obviously that's quite an invasive surgery and it's quite a long recovery time.
So obviously something we want to keep our eye on. What do we want to look at health-wise, health markers on our blood work to ensure that we don't run into this?
Well, you look at your blood values. So you look at your red blood cell count. You look at your hematocrit. And there's a whole section on a blood report that relates to red blood cell count within the blood. And it's all about keeping those in range and as near mid-range as you possibly can. A slight elevation is going to be beneficial to growth. Elevation too much and it's starting going to become a negative. And I think where we've got a little bit confused with the advantages of increasing RBC, because it's often quoted that it will increase nutritional transit, which it will, and it will increase oxygen transit, which it will, but that only becomes a positive in those that are hyperfit.
Okay.
When you're your average bodybuilder who's carrying probably 20 kilo more than he should do and doesn't have a particularly overly active life, then you're putting a huge amount of stress on a heart that's already having to work hard because you're a big boy. And there can be several things that can happen, but what also happens is your heart wall thickens, its efficiency at moving becomes less. It can't move as well. So the beat actually becomes weaker. Because the pump isn't... So if you get a bellows, imagine your heart's a bellows.
Okay.
And you're wanting to pump that bellows to create air to fuel your fire. If the skin on your bellows thickens and stiffens, you can't get a full pump. So now you're getting a much lower output of air onto your fire. And this is what happens in the heart. It can't, the stroke of the pump isn't as great. So the amount of blood moved at each point is less. That in turn will cause your body to increase RBC because you're starting to starve your body of oxygen. So the two things that also then happen is RBC increases even more, blood thickens even more, and your heart has to beat faster.
Yeah.
So as a result, your heartbeat becomes erratic and more panicked in its pace. Blood pressure increases, resting heart rate goes up, and you actually start suffering when it starts to get a severe problem, shortness of breath, because your body cannot literally push the blood around your body fast enough to provide your body with the oxygen it requires.
Yeah. Yeah. So I definitely think it's something important. It was something I didn't understand for some time. I remember when I first learned about it years ago, I remember talking to a guy who had had experiences with a negative experience with EQ. Signs were his face was super red all the time.
And
it was the red blood cells, you know, were so high. He basically was turning purple, you know, nonstop, and heart rate was always elevated. And yeah, he was getting really short of breath easily, you know, and getting kind of dizzy spells and stuff from that. And he ended up donating blood and eventually, you know, came off the EQ. But, you know, we talk about some more, I think, advanced stuff sometimes. And I know I'm going real basic with this, but I just thought since we were talking about it, it'd be a good opportunity. You know, I looked at the EPO insert and the guidelines on it. From what I understand, there is no clear designed, like, safe dosing that when they use it in the hospital, they basically, it's like a, I can't remember what the dosing was, if it was 21 days or whatever, but they would use it and then test the person's blood nonstop throughout.
Constantly monitoring the blood. Yeah, Andy Bolton, who, one of the side effects of dialysis, Andy Bolton's going through dialysis at the moment. I don't know if you know Andy Bolton, he's a world champion powerlifter.
You mentioned him before, and yeah. I've heard
first
of him.
First man to deadlift 1,000 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
He's going through dialysis, and one of the side effects of dialysis is a low red blood cell count.
Okay.
So he's now prescribed EPO. But he's constantly having to have blood tests and monitor his blood cells levels to make sure that they aren't going out of whack.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I've heard. It's a nonstop thing because it can go from, you know, okay, acceptable to sludge, basically, your blood.
Yeah.
You know, in a real quick period of time.
Yeah, which is why I've never been a fan of drugs that increase EQ, because I've always felt that our interest in elevated RBC has come from the endurance athlete world, and it's more of a negative to us because we don't have that conditioning that they do.
Yeah, that makes sense. So
our hearts struggle to cope with it, and very quickly it becomes problematic for our heart because the other thing is obviously we're carrying a lot more mass, so our hearts are already strained from that point.
Yeah.
So I don't see it the big advantage to strength athletes, and I'm putting bodybuilders in with that category as well, as I do to endurance athletes that are running marathons and cycling hundreds of miles in competition.
Yeah. All right, I'm looking at the thread here. I'm going to go to one more question. This is kind of more of a personal one for you, and I feel like we already touched on this to an extent when we're talking about dosing. You said, what's the highest doses in course and that you highest dose and course and what did you use? Results, side effects. I mean, I could tell him he could go to watch Under Construction 2 to find out all the answers to that, right?
Never went over 500 milligram of test and 20 D-ball to make a D-ball a day.
Good man.
Yeah, definitely. Highest dose, 3 gram of test, gram and a half of tren.
Yeah, I can't imagine that, man.
Results, shit. Probably the most effective dose I did was 3 gram of test and 1.5 grams of Deca.
Okay. That was effective to you. That felt like you were still getting some really good benefit from it.
I was still growing at the end of that cycle when it came off,
Really?
but I was getting to the point where it was starting to become very hard.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, the trend cycle, no, too toxic, way too toxic, should never run it that high.
It makes sense, Dave. All right.
And the Decca one was not so bad. But even then, I overran on the Decca because I think around 16 or 18 weeks.
Yeah, that's a long one, especially at that dose.
Yeah, it's ridiculous at that dose. And for the vast majority of it, I felt really good. It was only the last 3, 4 weeks I started to see the negatives. And even though I was still gaining, I wasn't feeling particularly good anymore.
Now, would you suggest this? Because I'm sure there's a reason he's asking. He wants to know what's the most he can run, is my guess.
What I fuck? No chance. I suggest that.
Okay.
Dosing's relative to the individual. It's relative to your experience. It's you don't need high doses to grow big,
Yeah.
but you will probably, all things being equal, need higher doses to grow quickly. And I think that's the big difference. My approach was very short term, very short sighted, and was deliberately excessive to see what happened with that amount of excess. It was not sustainable, and I sit here today with fucked kidneys, a dodgy heart, and various other bits and bats. And so, I didn't walk out of it free either. But no, I mean, the optimal dose for somebody is the ultimate dose for that person. I know that sounds a bit of a cop out, but everybody is different, and levels of development and levels of experience will work better at different doses.
Yeah.
You've just got to ease into it and stay low for as long as you can because there's stuff we still don't know about this shit. And some of the stuff that's come out in the last 2 or 3 years, we would never have even considered 5 years ago. So I'd rather, long term, you need to look at where you want to be in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years' time. And if you're quite happy to have health issues, never be able to use again, and have a restricted ability to train in 4 years' time, then go as high as you want. But bear in mind that that's the price you're probably going to end up having to pay for that.
Yeah.
And in other cases, it may even cost you your life.
Yeah.
And a few heart attacks in the last few weeks from users, luckily none of them fatal. But big life-changing experiences for those individuals because they've now had a heart attack.
Sure.
So, there is always a price to pay. And you've got to make sure you're willing to pay that price.
Yeah, Dave, I've noticed that I can't handle the orals the way I used to. Everything tests okay with my liver functions, but back in the day, maybe I just didn't pay as much attention. I don't know, but I could run, we'll say average 50 milligrams of D-ball a day, and I was fine with that. I was still eating. Now a few days in, man, that stuff just kills my appetite.
Yeah, well, I mean, at my heyday, I was doing 100 mg of Anabol and 100 mg of Anavar a day.
Do you think that that has to do with age, or do you think that has to do with having pushed it harder in the past like that, and not being able to handle it anymore because of it?
I'm not sure. I think to a large extent, it's age. I think as I've got older, my body's ability to handle toxicity reduces in the same way my recovery rate has changed.
Yeah, that all would make a lot more sense for sure.
I think also as I've got older, I think mentally we changed a great deal as well. And I think our desire and our ability to brush things off mentally changes.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so much more aware of potential injuries because I've had so many.
Yeah.
And that affects the way I train.
That's like, yeah, I could see that, man. We're not, we realize our mortality, you know, when you first walk in the gym, you're dumb. You've never been hurt. And until you do get hurt, you know, you don't stop and think about what that's like.
Some of that, I mean, you know, in the same way with my drug usage, you know, even if I was still using beyond therapeutic doses, I would never consider going to the levels I went to before.
Yeah.
Because one, I've been there and I don't need to go there again because I know what happens at those doses. And two, because I am hyper aware now what happens at those doses, I'm hyper cautious about what I do with those sort of things. In the same way, if you tear your pec off benching, you're going to be very, very careful on that bench from that day forward.
Yeah, that's true.
And you see a lot of people that just won't even do the exercise anymore. And it's the same, you know, it's the same with drugs. I have a much greater respect for these drugs having gone through the experience of abusing them.
Sure, of course you do.
And I mean, they say that about people. And there were points in my usage where I'm addicted, potentially. Definitely a change in priority. Definitely became more drug focused and less training focused. And whereas my previous approach would have been, how can I make this training harder? How can I eat more food? My approach became, how can I take more drugs?
Sure.
What's the chemical answer to this problem? And I was never like that. And that was a mental shift and change that happened. So yeah, you know, high doses, do they work? If everything else is equal to a point, yes, but there does become a point of diminishing returns, and that's down to every individual.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is a good place to cut off, Dave. We got some good info out there. And I, like I said, once again, guys, I encourage you, head over to the forum and think of some good questions so to add to some discussion for next episode. And we could always use some Dear Davey questions. So and they've been getting good. The Dear Davey questions we've gotten in the last few shows have been pretty awesome. So I think we need to get some more of those. We don't have one of those for next week lined up yet. What do you got going on today, Dave?
Paperwork, and paperwork. And then on the road tomorrow, seeing a couple of clients, and then Thursday is even more paperwork. I've finished a report I've been working on for ages, sent it off, only to have it sent back to say, you forgot to do this bit.
Oh.
Luckily, it's a quick fix. It's only a day's work.
Excellent.
I've got to nip down to the garage and pick my wife's car up tonight because it's had some work done on it. Got to take my youngest to Army Cadets this evening. And General just answering, you know what we haven't done in ages?
What's that?
A word of the day type week thing.
Ooh. Do you have one for us?
I don't know. Do you use the word frigging in America?
Frigging. We might use it. Yeah, we might use it like in place of the F word, like that yeah. Freaking guy.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that's the same then. So I haven't got one today. Then I'll have to take one.
If you guys have a word of the day for us, I want to learn some new British terminology. You can post those up at the message board too. In that case, man, let's get out of here, Dave. What do you say?
Yeah, you too, mate. You take care now.
All right, guys, for another episode of Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland, I'm Scott McNally. Go to the show notes. You can click on all of Dave's links. Check out his YouTube. And guys, we will see you soon.
Crisis Radio Network.